Okay, thank you very much. So Red October came out of my dissertation project at the University of Toronto in political science, and I first went to Bolivia in 2000, much before I'd started my dissertation research, and I had been going back every year, and then I went to live there in 2005, 2006 for when I was working on what became this. But when I finished the dissertation, my draft was 950 pages, and I gave it to my dissertation supervisor, who I hadn't talked to in 4 years, and she said, "This has to be 420 pages maximum if we were going to get an external to read it." So I have two books on sale now. the second half is basically From Rebellion to Reform. So the book that I'm talking about today really deals with the long history of capitalist development, state formation, and traditions of struggle that undergird the real focus of the book, which is the 2000 to 2005 left indigenous insurrectionary period in Bolivia. So in other words, this book is not about the Morales government or the political economy of the Morales government. It's about what came before. And the other book, which I'm not going to talk about today, deals more with the first 3 years of Morales. So the first four chapters deal with this long history of the way in which Bolivia was incorporated into the world market and the way in which it transformed into a capitalist economy, first through silver and then through tin commodity production, and then a series of others. Today, it's natural gas is the principal basis of what is still a primary commodity export-based capitalist economy. So I trace that out, and I trace alongside it the forms of state formation that were embedded in that process. And the purpose of that long history was motivated by the two main theoretical frameworks that I tried to critique in the book. One is the liberal institutionalist framework that was dominant mostly in political science, but also in other disciplines of social science, sociology, anthropology, and so on, in relationship to indigenous movements of the 90s, which were seen to be very new things that were emerging out of the democratization process, the movement from authoritarianism to electoral democracy, and that although neoliberalism may have had some negative consequences on some of the material aspects of these people's lives, it had also given opened up space for these movements to emerge. And it was also said by this literature that the decline of the left was actually massively important for the rise of indigenous movements. Indigenous movements were given space that the left had ostensibly shut down. So this was just complete bullshit in the Bolivian case. I mean, it is remarkable that there was published material making this argument. Obviously, I put it slightly softer if we were at a different conference, but I'm assuming we can speak more frankly here. So what it's so what I wanted to do then was to trace, in fact, the very, very long history of complicated relations between indigenous movements and then the left later on, which were sometimes in tension and other times working in congruence with very similar goals. And it often involved, in fact, the same people who could not understand, in fact, the separation of their own identities into these various treatments that treated these things as entirely distinct. And that has to do with the particular way in which capitalism was racialized in the Bolivian context, mm-hmm. in which indigenous oppression was inextricably bound up in capitalist social relations. And so it was unsurprising in many ways that resistance to a racialized form of capitalism took on what I call a combined liberation struggle informed by a combined oppositional consciousness that was both anti-capitalist and indigenous liberationist simultaneously, and didn't think that that a liberation in one domain could actually be achieved without the liberation on the other. And a controversial kind of aside I make in terms of comparison is with the South African example of racialized capitalist formation there, in the sense that the African National Congress and those on its left, when they were fighting apartheid, very much saw the character of the racialization of capitalism in South Africa and saw this as a simultaneous struggle. But once the 1994 election of Nelson Mandela happens, you see a division of this combined struggle into a struggle of distinct stages in which effectively the anti-capitalist component and even the anti-neoliberal component now in the South African case is set to one side, and black liberation becomes reduced to a question of forming effectively a black bourgeoisie where the majority of black proletarians are in materially worse circumstances in some respects than they were under apartheid. Now, obviously, I'm not giving a talk about South Africa, but I have to be clear that the end of apartheid was a world historic victory. That's not the point. But the point is that there was this combined liberation struggle that was then divided, and I'm suggesting something not totally dissimilar was at play in the case of Bolivia. So the first four chapters try and trace this out, and then they point to two basic popular cultures of opposition and resistance. Now, this is obviously a very crude way of putting it. These two cultures are very complicated, and there's different currents inside of them. But for the purposes, even in the book, but especially for a 20-minute presentation, we'll just accept that there are these two currents, and I'll tell you what they are. One goes back to at least 1781 with the biggest anti-colonial rebellion in the Andes, led in the Bolivian, or what became Bolivia, by Tupac Katari and the resistance that he mounted with tens of thousands against the Spanish colonizers. And at the end of this, when they laid siege to La Paz, which is the capital, which is located in a very odd geographic formation in which there are very few exits, you're in this big valley. And if you block the valley from what is contemporary El Alto, or on the other side of the city, there's basically no way out. And it was a very poor decision to set up camp there in terms of the ruling class, but that is ultimately when silver economy became important. That's where they eventually went. And in any case, so the tradition of Tupac Katari was to starve them out for 3 weeks, and it came very close to, together with the rebellions in what is today Peru, with causing major problems for the Spanish project in the Andes. But Tupac Katari, the reason why you begin in 1791 at least, is that Katari was drawn and quartered once he was eventually captured, meaning he had his four limbs tied to four different horses and had his body pulled apart by the Spanish troops. And before he did so, he reportedly said that he is one man, but he will return as millions. And in the contemporary context of El Alto, or virtually anywhere in the western part of Bolivia, this is seen in some senses quite literally, in other senses figuratively, as people being the embodiment of his return, as the millions in the streets. You know, exemplified in movements called the Cateristas and other things like this. So the one tradition is all of the indigenous movements that continued to persist from 1781 until the present, obviously with highs and lows and different formations and with different allies and so on. But nonetheless, never disappearing, even after 1825 when the independence of Bolivia was founded. It became then a fight against internally colonial racial relations between a white mestizo elite and the indigenous peasant and then later proletarian majority of the country. And this is very important to understand for those of you who may not know much about Bolivia. It's one of only two countries in Latin America in which the indigenous population survived conquest in a majoritarian situation. The other is Guatemala. So, you know, 62% of the population self-identify as indigenous in the latest census, which is 2000, 2001. So what I want to do in the remaining, there's Okay, so now I need to say the other tradition, which is a much kind of later phenomenon that develops only when capitalist social relations are fully established. Now, there's a whole historiographical debate about when that happens, but the position in my book that I'm not going to really defend, I'm just going to say when it happens is in the late 19th century when you start to see a real process of primitive accumulation that runs deep enough to establish capitalist social relations on the basis of tin commodity production, when it moves from silver into tin. And out of this emerges what became the most militant labor movement in the 20th century in Latin America, and quite a unique labor movement based in the tin mines, driven by, unique because it was Trotskyists and anarcho-syndicalists at the helm, together at different points, obviously with nationalist populists and a small Stalinist formation. But what was distinct is that the Communist Party of a Stalinist type didn't ever hold majority in the most militant wing of the labor movement. And this creates a very, very different dynamic from virtually anywhere else in Latin America. And so these tin miners are basically the vanguard of the revolutionary left, the Marxist tradition. And these two traditions, which I'm treating as kind of separate for analytical purposes, at different times are very much intertwined. So you see inside of the, you know, Trotskyist anarcho-syndicalist minds, all kinds of indigenous rituals still alive inside of the minds at the same time as you're talking about Lenin, you're talking about Tupac Katari and so on, and these come in very, very organic ways, and they're not seen as kind of opposing forces. But nonetheless, these two traditions don't always exist in sort of without tension. But when they come together, you've seen the most explosive moments in Bolivian history, and the best moments in terms of advancing the interests of the majority of the Bolivian popular classes. And this is what happens in 2000 to 2005. For the latest period of left indigenous cooperation and insurgency. But before that, I think you need to understand the period between 1985 and 2000 in order to understand why there was a revolt. It didn't just come from nowhere, and there's a reason why it happened at this time. So in 1985, after electoral democracy is achieved in 1982 through very heroic struggle against a series of right-wing dictatorships that had been in place since 1964, you see a period of 3 years of center-left government, which ends in a hyperinflationary crisis at the same time as the debt crisis is unfolding throughout the entire region. And so that the tenure of that government is cut short, elections are pulled up, and there's basically a struggle to have a socialist exit to that crisis or a neoliberal exit. The situation was that polarized. And for those of you who are familiar with Latin American history, you'll understand that neoliberals won not just in Bolivia that contest, but virtually everywhere in the region. But in Bolivia, perhaps apart from Chile under Pinochet, you had the most orthodox experimentation of this model. With no less a figure than Jeffrey Sachs being, before he went and ruined the lives of those in what is now post-Soviet Eastern Europe and so on, he started out his practice in Bolivia, writing together with the ministers of finance the first structural adjustment program there. And the reason this is so important as a juncture is not just a kind of dating when neoliberalism starts, but to see neoliberalism not simply as a technocratic economic policy, but as a political project that had to defeat the miners, because the miners were the problem for unfolding this agenda, and the first thing to be attacked was therefore the miners. So if you think, for those of you who have North America or Europe in your kind of historical memory closer to you, if you think about Reagan's defeat of the air traffic controllers, or if you think about Thatcher's defeat of the miners in England, these were the sort of quintessential breaking points that allowed for the unfolding of what came next. And in Bolivia, although the miners only represented ever 10% of the actively working population, it was the entire source of foreign exchange for the country. So when they went on strike, it meant the end of the proper functioning of capitalism in the country. And so they were massively strategically important. And when they privatized the mines and eliminated effectively the jobs of 30,000 miners, it had a devastating short-term and medium-term impact for the ability of the left to fight back. And so you see, I'm going to move more quickly into the contemporary period. But basically, to put a longer story much shorter, you have a transformation of the class structure such that you have, in one hand, a process of a particular kind of re-peasantization of some miners, responding in a certain way to the neoliberal axiom that says that you ought to focus on your comparative advantage. Countries should produce those commodities that they can produce most cheaply and sell most dearly on the international market. This happened to be cocaine at the juncture of the mid-80s, as everyone was getting into blow in North America. The price got very high, and although they were at the lowest end of this commodity chain, with much higher end industrialization happening in Colombia, it nonetheless was the key survival strategy for all kinds of ex-miners who had lost their jobs. And so smallholding peasants have not historically always been the basis for of revolutionary subjects, but nonetheless, in this case, it was a very particular kind of smallholding peasantry because they were growing an illegal crop that were constantly under military assault. Because at the same time as you had neoliberal structural adjustment, you had the militarization of the war on drugs, which started with the Drug Enforcement Agency coordinating Bolivian military assaults on the miners. And it was out of that milieu that the Cocaleros emerged, and it was out of that milieu that Evo Morales eventually found his political life, first as a coca grower union leader, and so on. But however heroic you see the coca growers' struggle to be, and I think it was the most important struggle of the 1990s. It was a defensive struggle that carried none of the weight of the earlier period that the miners held of the earlier part of the 20th century. In other words, this is still a period of right-wing advance, a massive advance for the right, almost without effective contestation for 15 years, which is why, when South America as a whole enters into a very deep recession between 1998 and 2002, the crisis of neoliberalism in Bolivia, the way it particularly manifested, is so important. Because the entire region enters into a recession, Bolivia enters into a recession, and the answer of the ruling classes across South America, and Bolivia was no exception, was simply an acceleration of neoliberalism. So the idea was we hadn't gone far enough. There was invisible red tape that we still need to cut, et cetera. And the answer in particular was the privatization of water, something that hadn't been considered ever in the history of Bolivia. And there's all kinds of machinations to this that are quite interesting that I tried to explore in the book. But the key thing is that in Cochabamba, you had an explosion around the privatization of water, and they reversed the privatization of water. There's a complex story to tell there. But the important thing is that they won. They won, and obviously that is a defensive struggle and a very basic grievance. Potable water, the ability to have a healthy life as a poor person in Cochabamba. But it was massively important because it was the first reversal of neoliberal advance in 15 years. So that example and the example of coordination from below that it demonstrated the power of that kind of mobilization starts to build the momentum for what was eventually, over the next 5 years, an increasingly offensive struggle of left indigenous social forces, reaching its apogee. There's all kinds of basically constant mobilization, rural and urban, of different kinds over the next 5 years. But the culminating kind of moments are what are called the gas wars. And if you think about the gas wars and you think about from where it came, but the water war, a defense against the privatization of water. By the end of this cycle, the main demand amongst many others is the renationalization of the central source of foreign exchange in the entire country. This is a much more offensive demand, and you see a much more offensive or defensive assault, militarized assault from those in power, with a gunning down of 67 civilians in one particular intense episode in October 2003. The name of the book is Red October. After that period. And the geographic center of mobilization turned from Cochabamba, which was a secondary city, to the capital, La Paz, and its shanty town, El Alto, which is technically a separate city, but effectively acts as the kind of informal proletarian source of labor for the capital. And it's a contiguous urban area. And so effectively, for 3 weeks, they shut down the entire western part of the country, but particularly the capital, overthrowing the president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, for 14 months, accepting a negotiated exit with Carlos Mesa, Sanchez de Lozada's vice president. But then when he seems to be continuing the same process, they overthrow him in the second gas war of May, June 2005. And this is what lays the basis for the presidency of Evo Morales. He didn't come out of the ether. He came out of an entire history of struggle. And more controversially, I'll leave it for questions. I think he was more of a damming of that flood than the culmination of that rise. So I'll end it there.
Thank you, Jeff. I mean, for people that haven't seen these two books or heard some of the arguments rehearsed before, I think, just to make it clear, methodologically, politically, these are two books that are very much on the same page for a lot of reasons. As you said, Morales didn't come out of the ether. The same insistence serves as sort of both the starting point and kind of paradoxically as the conclusion of my book, We Created Chavez, precisely because the Bolivarian Revolution, as it's called frequently, referring to a variety of different things, whether it's the presidency of Chavez or a whole broader tendency, was never centrally or even primarily about Hugo Chavez. And I think it's only from, the reason I say it's a starting point as well as a conclusion, is that it's only from that sort of insistence that we can avoid missing the thread entirely to begin with. Because if we start from the assumption, what I call sort of the errors of the right, the far, you know, the right and the left, that focus so heavily on Chavez, that they simply can't see what's going on. So, you know, it's the missing the forest for the trees. And so it's only on the basis of insisting kind of that we're going to take a different view and take a different understanding of what's going on in Venezuela, what has happened there historically, that we can begin to generate a new history and circle back around to a complex understanding of Chavez. It's only sort of by pushing him aside at first that we can then come to an assessment of his important role in this process. Like Jeff, the central sort of approach is to take the struggles going on in contemporary Venezuela, situate them historically, insist that they're part of a much longer history, decades-long history, and to, on top of simply situating them to, and here's another thing that we share, is to pay particular attention to moments of mass upsurge and rupture, moments of mass power in the streets, and what it is that those moments, those events, as someone like Badu would call them, make possible, right? What possibilities they break open, and how often in these moments, it's precisely mass power in the streets, masses of people moving themselves that surpass, overcome, push beyond their own self-appointed or appointed leadership. Now, I start this history in Venezuela. In general, of course, we go way back. I talk about prior antecedents, but I started most centrally in 1958. And that's kind of, on some level, a strange place to start a history of the Bolivarian Revolution, because 1958 was when democracy, representative liberal democracy, was established in a stable way in Venezuela with the overthrow of the last unelected dictator, Marcos Pérez Jiménez. What's important about starting at this moment is not only the fact that this was also simultaneously the beginning of concrete struggles against this liberal democratic regime, but it was precisely the fact that those who took up arms within a couple of short years, by 1960, there was a guerrilla struggle, those who took up arms against this increasingly repressive liberal representative democracy, it's not simply the fact that they were struggling, it's also the fact that they were struggling against this form of democracy, which provides a sort of a powerful lineage which continues today in Venezuela. We can't actually understand what's going on in contemporary Venezuela unless we understand it as a struggle against a certain kind of liberal democracy. This was a democracy that was immediately, almost immediately repressive when students, when campesinos, when workers, when the unemployed took to the streets to attempt to radicalize this new democratic government, which many of them, you know, were still at least initially excited by. They were gunned down, they were attacked, and what was built over a period of decades was a very exclusionary, heavily structured and buffered form of democracy, so that the two dominant parties essentially had a whole series and layers of organizations that were used to channel and to control all forms of dissent. Anything that was outside of it was repressed rather ferociously, and the major thing that fell outside of it was the guerrilla struggle, already in the early 1960s. Now, the guerrilla struggle in Venezuela was not particularly impressive or successful or extensive in terms of the numbers of people involved, but there are a couple of reasons that it's important. One is that simply as a concrete predecessor to what's going on there today, the guerrilla struggle is fundamental. This goes even for the question of the dozens of former guerrillas who are involved in the Bolivarian government today, but also for the lessons and the sort of seeds that were planted in the failure of the guerrilla struggle. In the failure of that struggle toward the end of the 1960s, we see the seeds eventually planted for the development of a whole series of social movements, revolutionary movements across society. And these began even as debates within the guerrilla struggle, whether it be questions of race, gender, the party, the function of the party, questions of what kind of Marxism to draw inspiration from, and this question fundamentally of what you can call broadly Bolivarianism. This came out of the guerrilla struggle as a result of struggling with sort of foreign imposed models of how to make a revolution, what was seen as a sort of Eurocentric Marxism versus some indigenous, meaning either Latin American or indigenous Venezuelan, socialisms and Marxisms. And so Bolivarianism, even in the 1960s and the 1970s, meant struggling with this question of looking for local roots of rebellion, kind of sort of almost sort of syncretically drawing these together with Marxism, with anti-colonial struggles. And part of the outgrowth of this experimentation theoretically was the practical development of sort of a multitude of revolutionary movements across society. On a military level, it's also worth noting that one of the major self-critiques of the guerrilla struggle, one of the major failures of it, if you had to reduce it to one element, which isn't necessarily the best way to go, it's something to do with vanguardism. It was vanguardism that a certain kind of hard-headed vanguardism that led to the military defeat on some level of these guerrillas, inspired by some of the erroneous approaches of someone like Debray to guerrilla struggle, the attempt to implant this into Venezuela, the assumption that if someone didn't follow the popular struggle embodied in the guerrilla movement, that it was really sort of, they were back, and they simply weren't getting what was going on. And it's in struggling with this vanguardism that a lot of what emerges afterward begins to develop. And one aspect of this on a military level or on a sort of paramilitary level is a return or shift from sort of Foquista guerrilla war of small sort of mobile units moving around and sort of creating politics out of the barrel of a gun, to a return to concepts of self-defense. And this had been a debate in the 50s and 60s, and Debray was very critical of the early FARC guerrillas for relying on self-defense. He essentially thought that if you sort of seized fixed areas, you were sitting duck and the military could destroy you. But the reality is that the political importance of generating mass support and generating the structures of mass support in fixed areas proved to be more long-standing than Debray's approach. And so we had a return to this in Venezuela, in part in the urban area. And so in the 1980s, along with these social movements, you also had the development and proliferation of self-defense militias, many communist militias, people who had been involved in the guerrilla struggle but abandoned on some level the idea of at least prioritizing offensive warfare and focusing on the development of political structures, politicized militias in poor neighborhoods, especially in the barrios around into the west of Caracas. One important aspect of what is shared when you look at all these different movements, even whether it be student movements or women's movements or Afro-Indigenous movements developing in the 70s and 80s and 90s, is that they're all sort of struggling for a unified conception of what they're, of themselves. They're all struggling for autonomy from the state, and they're all attempting to fit themselves into a broader struggle. It's rarely the case that you have movements that or there are constant debates within these movements about whether or not, for example, in the women's movement, whether or not we're going to be a feminist movement, or whether we're part of a communist movement and a socialist movement. This is a long-standing debate in a lot of these movements. Now, when we hit the 1980s, Jeff alluded to this sort of period of widespread neoliberalization across Latin America, the lost decade of sort of massively destructive economic policies imposed generally from abroad. And the 1980s in Venezuela was really a crucible into which, on the one hand, you have these belligerent movements. On the other hand, you have a powerful economic crisis beginning in 1983. You have the response to that crisis, which was first heterodox and then later orthodox neoliberal reforms. And you have, as a result of all this, a widening state repression. In the beginning, the state was sort of targeting small groups of armed militants and killing them. And then you had the, you know, then you had the state targeting small groups of unarmed sort of social movements linked to militants and killing them. And then you have ultimately the poor as a class becoming a target of this, and sort of the intersection of all of these contrasting tensions and pressures in the massive rebellions of 1989 known as the Caracazo. This is really the event of events in recent Venezuelan history. It's called, you know, when history broke in half. And when, most specifically, the image of Venezuela as the most stable, liberal, representative democracy in Latin America was just shattered irreparably. And that, sort of on a methodological point, it's important to really grapple with the fact that suddenly things that were absolutely impossible prior to that became possible. And so this is sort of something we need to struggle with as revolutionaries. How can we grasp, 10 minutes, how can we grasp the importance of these moments, and not simply the fact of being a rupture, but also the fact that that rupture coincided with thousands and thousands of people in the streets reappropriating, looting, sacking, burning, and the result of which was up to 3,000 dead and disappeared. From this moment, 1989, which was a response to this neoliberal reform package, everything else follows. Albeit not in a linear way. Most directly, the 1992 coup attempt by Chavez follows. It was initially scheduled to be on the third anniversary of the rebellion, but had to be moved up to February 4th of 1992. It was in this moment that, you know, that Chavez became overnight a sort of celebrity and expression of these popular struggles, because he stood up on television in a sort of mediatic genius moment and said, you know, we'll lay down our arms if you let me go on live TV. And so Chavez goes on TV, and he does two very important things. One is to take responsibility for failing that day. He says, we didn't accomplish our task. You know, I'm sorry. And this is something that's very, you know, for a country that's accustomed to nothing but lying and irresponsibility among political leaders, this is something that was really striking to people. And the other thing was to say that we've failed por ahora, for now, essentially promising that, you know, this is compare to when Castro at his trial says history will absolve me. You know what I mean? Essentially, this is the beginning. There will be more to come. It was from this, from 1989 and from the chain of events that links 89 to 92 and the coup that Chavez eventually is elected in 1998 over many of his own concerns. He didn't want to run in elections. Elections were seen to be too much part of the system, and the point was to destroy and attack that system. But what was unfolding, and what he maybe didn't realize right away, was that the system was being broken open from 89 to 92, and that elections suddenly mattered in a way that they certainly didn't 10 years prior to that. So Chavez was elected in 1998, and this dynamic of mass power really continues during the course of Chavez's period in power, his 14 years as president. Not only is it the movements pressing from below, pushing for him to radicalize, but it's also the whip of the counter-revolution, right? The attacks from the right. And I think it was Marta Harnacker said, she referred to this as a counter-revolution without a revolution, because interestingly, Chavez had not really done all that much by 2000, 2001. His economic program was very moderate, and he was still speaking in terms of a sort of third way between socialism and capitalism. But even in this attempt to make minor reforms, he was smashed hard from the right while being pushed from the left. And it's in this period that, if we're talking about, you know, the book, the title of the book is We Created Chavez, and the Chavez that was elected in 1998 was very, very different after a few years. And so this question of how is this person transformed, how does it become perfectly clear to him that there's no way, there's no third way between capitalism and socialism? And part of it is because the right is so aggressive, and part of it is because these movements are inspiring and pushing and developing these struggles from below. Now, this is normally like how the story goes, right? There's a revolutionary founding moment, an upsurge, a rupture. Someone is propelled into power. And then there's this slow process of sort of decadence in which they get slightly worse and slightly worse and slightly worse. And at some point, you know, they become just like everyone else. And the processes, this is something internal to processes as well, because the energy, the memory of that moment of the 3,000 dead in 1989 fades, right? But one militant leader in Venezuela said something to me once that really stuck. And he said, this is a process that has had the advantage of moving from event to event. Meaning after 1989, Chavez is propelled into power. And then the coup of 2002 marked another sort of energizing, radicalizing event which allowed people to mobilize and created another moment of rupture. It allowed, in a way, for the re-energization of the process. For those that don't know, Chavez was overthrown for like 47 hours. Millions of people pour into the streets, making it perfectly clear that that this coup wasn't going to stand, or that civil war, you know, could be the result if it didn't. If it did. And so you have this another moment of mass power in the streets actually reversing a coup in a very unprecedented way. And this provides for not only the remobilization, the re-energization of the process, but also the powerful political defeat of the opposition, in which they're absolutely tossed aside and become useless electorally. They can't win elections, and so the revolutionary forces have, on some level, a free hand. It's not without its own dangers. But it's in this period that you really have the beginnings of the institutionalization of popular power in Venezuela. We can talk about that more later on. But I want to just briefly maybe speak a little bit about what this means for post-Chavez Venezuela, because, of course, things have changed. Things are slightly different, very much different. The first point is just a basic one, which is not going to be a surprise to anyone in this room, namely the fact that if Chavez himself was the result of these revolutionary movements that have decades sort of long legacies, then the revolution's not going anywhere, right? Or at least these revolutionary forces, especially their most organized elements, are not simply going to throw in the towel because, you know, I mean, even if they lost an election, I'm not sure if they would throw in the towel, but they haven't. And so the question is not so much one of is the revolution going to exist tomorrow, but what form it's going to take, what kind of struggles are required for it to become radicalized. The second aspect, and again, I don't think it's particularly scandalous for this crowd, is that it's not about building representative democracy. And it's important because a lot of what we hear in the media, and even on the left, has powerful traces of liberalism built into it. And there are good reasons for this, right? I mean, if you hear there are a lot of people right now that want the opposition candidate for the, you know, that ran against Maduro last month to be arrested because of the deaths that happened afterward. And I'm not saying that that's the best thing strategically, but there were people on the left that would sort of scandalize, and it would sort of speak of a kind of overrunning of the separation of powers and the judiciary and et cetera. And these are structures of liberal democracy that have never been the objective of this process. It's not to say that useful to throw them all out at once, but the point is that this is a class war. The point is that, you know, one of the most scandalizing things was that there was a list called the Tascón list that became very public after the 2004 referendum, which the public list of people who signed in support of a referendum to recall Chavez, these things were already public, but it began to be used as a way to filter people out of employment. And this is very scandalous, of course, across Venezuela. But the reality is, when you're trying to build a revolutionary process, it's very difficult to say that we want to build this process, but we don't want to step on any toes. We don't want to exclude anyone from, say, working in a ministry. When working in a ministry is something that, if you're against the revolution, there's a lot of damage you can do to it. I mean, witness this. There's this sort of inertia built into the bureaucratic apparatus, which is still very much full of counter-revolutionary elements. So it's not about building representative democracy. It's actually about building, and the hope is that in the next months and years it'll be clear, it's about building a new state, if you want to call it a state. They're calling it a state, that's why I use the word, called a communal state, right? And it's actually being built alongside the existing liberal state apparatus in an effort to displace it. And the hope is that it will displace it. This is essentially the verticalization of the horizontally organized communal councils, popular, directly democratic structures, and the question of how to integrate these into an apparatus capable of replacing this old state and building something entirely new. Finally, 2 minutes. At this moment, now that Chavez is gone, this revolution has to radicalize. But I say that in part because of electoral impulses. There's a tendency, and there will be a tendency in Venezuela for people to think that since Maduro was almost defeated in this election, that they need to sort of reach out to the center. But the point is not that, I mean, Chavez never did not come to power by reaching out to the center. I mean, there are maneuvers that go on here and there, but the reality is he presided over, and he himself was transformed by this, presided over the dragging of the political spectrum to the left. You know, it's not about seeking the center, it's about pulling everyone to the left in the course of a political process. And so what the Bolivarian Revolution needs to do these days, if it wants to get reelected, is to show not that it can be like the other moderate forces in the country, but that it is something completely different. Because the reality is, if someone, you know, is glad that they have free healthcare and free education, but on the daily sort of like experience level, they witness corruption, they witness violence. You know, these things are not going to attract people to a process when what they experience is more continuity than difference, right? So the task is really to erect a new moment of rupture and push this process forward in a radical direction. So that's what I got. I think we're going to have a conversation here for a minute.
All right.
So now, because our panelists have each spent more time with each other's books than I assume everyone in the audience has, we're going to give them a couple minutes to sort of offer critique and reflections on one another's work. So they're going to get about 5 minutes each to talk about the other one's book, and then we will open it up to the audience for questions.
Okay, thanks very much. And it's a privilege, not just because how good the book is, but it's a privilege to talk about it, George's book. Because for those of us on the left, the last little period when we've been talking about Venezuela after Chavez's death has been mostly confined to defending ourselves against, not ourselves, but the process against the kind of caricature of and demonization of the process by the bourgeois media. So we can put that aside and have a much more interesting conversation about left debates and arguments about the actual process in a way that touches base with reality. And I think this is an extraordinary book in the sense I think it's the best book available in English so far on the contemporary process. And I've read a lot of books on the process, and I still took 46 pages of single space notes on this one. So I learned a lot from reading it. And I think it's a corrective because it's a history from below, and you know, lots of people say they do histories from below. It's more difficult to carry out than to pledge your allegiance to a history from below. Mm. It involves some work. Mm. And I think this corrects, you know, other books that have their strengths but that have been, you know, the resource for people who read English. You know, Steve Elner's Rethinking Venezuelan Politics, an important book, but with quite a few significant things made invisible that are made visible here. Gregory Wilpert's book with Verso, similarly missing a lot of these dynamics. Richard Gott's book on Bolivia and so on. You know, you should read these books if you have time, but I would, you know, this angle that George brings in, I think, is much richer and complements the character of the other ones. And I think part of it is just the scope is fairly extraordinary. I mean, 1958 to the present is not a huge expanse of time, but there are moments when he goes back. I mean, it's not a linear. It's not a postmodern book, so you don't have to worry about the. It's not non-linear in a pejorative way, but in a way that's interesting, that dips back into history, connecting the contemporary period with the old. But it's more the scope of the breadth of movements involved. So beginning with rural guerrilla movements and a very nice critique of Debray's theory, which you know was hashed out in the 70s, but needed to be done again for contemporary audiences who still find that appealing, although no one could find Debray appealing today, presumably, in the room. And then, you know, the urban guerrilla movements, the legacies of the rural insurgencies inside of urban popular organizations in the barrios of Caracas, and the attention too often missing in other books and characterizations of the role of women, indigenous movements, peasants, Afro-Venezuelans in this context, and the interpenetration of gender, class, and race in all of these dynamics, together with as well a treatment of formal workers' movements and informal workers' movements. So there's a lot going on, and I think part of the methodology, what makes it rich, is a grasp of the literature in Spanish, the stuff coming out of Venezuela itself, which is always an indication that someone is remotely serious when you start to do this stuff, that you begin with what is being produced out of the processes that you're studying, but also connecting in theoretically sophisticated ways with Fanon, C.L.R. James, and theorists inside of the movement, Roland Dennis, Carlos Lanz, and others. So I think it's a very important book. Well, we promised not to make it a complete love-in at the session. So I'm going to use. Do I have 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to use the rest to
savage
the book that is the best. All right. So the first thing is, I think just 4 quick points. I think there's an imbalance between. You know, some of this is going to sound like, why didn't you write a different book, the one that I would have written, but. Nonetheless, an imbalance between the subjective and objective components of the Bolivarian process, or if you want to put it another way, between the political economy of capitalist development and state formation in Venezuela and the agential forms of social agency that have emerged through the interstices of these structures. And as a result, so, I mean, the weight is towards the subjective identity, the subjective understanding of revolutionary subjects and so on. And as a result, I think there's a tendency, and it's easy to exaggerate this tendency because there's all kinds of care and rigor in the book, but there is a tendency toward what I think is a certain voluntarism as a result of this. And it's associated, or an associated element of that, in addition to a certain voluntarism, is a tendency to, I think, exaggerate what has changed in terms of the political economy of Venezuela under Chavez. Second critique is related to this, and that has to do with the state form. And I'm sure we'll probably have a discussion about this in other ways as well. But because the capitalist social relations of production informing Venezuelan political economy is, in my view, relatively under-theorized in the book, its association with the state form in Venezuela is gestured at, but is not sufficiently characterized, I don't think. And as a result, the malleability of the state is exaggerated. So, and I don't want to exaggerate in the sense that the state isn't presented as infinitely malleable and is nonetheless seen as all kinds of problematic, you know, engagement with it. But to caricature this slightly, there's a dynamic which is a dialectic between Chavez and maybe certain figures around him who are ideologically on the left of Chavismo. Movements from below, a synergistic dialectic against the principal internal enemy, which is a bureaucratic middle layer. And basically, there's a sense in which if you were to eliminate that bureaucratic layer by all kinds of complicated parallel structures and counterpower and so on, then the problem of the state would somehow be resolved. But nowhere is the social property relations undergirding the capitalist state form sufficiently tackled to suggest to me, to convince me that this is going to go that way, or that we're anywhere near that. And as a consequence, I would not call I would not call what's happening in Venezuela a revolution. Although I understand the polemical reasons I wouldn't, you know, call people out for calling it a revolution when they're there or something, but I just think it makes sense not to call everything a revolution when if we want to be serious about what a revolution entails, which is, for me, a change in the fundamental social and class structures of society, need to be overturned. The same people can't be in control of the means of production at the end of a revolution as were in control at the beginning. And so levels of participation, I'm totally convinced that there's been this upsurge and so on. That's not the argument. But the argument is, has there been a revolution and is there even moving momentum in that direction? Do I have time for one more point?
Go ahead.
Okay. So this comes back to the exceptionalism thesis, which for people is a little bit particular to Venezuela. People might not have heard of it, but there's a thing called the exceptionalism thesis, or maybe they didn't call it that, but it's been called that by people who disagree with it. And the exceptionalism thesis, I think George is absolutely right. Okay, so first, what is the exception? The exception is that Venezuela, because of oil wealth, has developed since 1958 until 1998 maybe, at least 1989, a strange phenomenon in Latin America that made Venezuela closer to Europe than to the rest of Venezuela, because class compromise was built into the structure, lubricated by oil wealth that allegedly lessened the intensity of class struggle and prevented the violence elsewhere. And you had in the worst articulations of this issue, you had like the ideal non-participatory liberal democracy that we all desire. And so I think he's absolutely right, together with others who have challenged this thesis, to expose what this makes invisible. The violence of the state, the ongoing movements from below, all of that I'm on board with. But I think there is a tendency to move, to bend the stick the other way, to say there was a certain exceptionalism to Venezuela in the sense that you didn't have mass guerrilla insurgencies that you had in Central America. You didn't have the kinds of authoritarian regimes that emerged in Southern Cone that annihilated in a way that is incredible the bases of the left. And this is part of the reason why, in fact, you can have what's happening in Venezuela today, because you didn't have the annihilation of a whole layer of people off the earth, as you did in most of Central America and the Southern Cone. So I'll just leave it there.
I'm afraid that I can't top the sort of generous introduction you gave to my book. I'll say I'm lucky enough to have read the whole. How many pages was it? 900 or something? because sorry to say that while this book is about sort of the long-term history generating not the Morales presidency in a direct way, but these sort of explosions, these popular moments of constituent rupture, constituent moments that make that possible, but also other things. You'll be sort of unsurprised to find that I'm more interested in pushing on this question of what comes right at the end of this book, right? What comes right after, in the direct aftermath of the gas wars, of the constituent people in the streets overthrowing their leaders, right? And how do we then conceptualize the state, participation in that state, participation in elections, on the basis of those movements, on the basis of this understanding of power and its operation. As I said, and I don't want to repeat this necessarily, I think methodologically there's a lot that we share. One is this question of mass power, and one is this question of a historical approach to understanding these moments of rupture and explosions. And this will come out, I think, in sort of a very narrow range. I mean, the narrow range of critique that Jeff has just given me, I'm going to give back, I think, a little bit, you know, and I think the parameters will be kind of clear by the end. Toward the end of Red October, and Jeff mentioned it, he suggests that the MAS and Evo Morales served as a break on a revolution or a dam for revolutionary movements. And to maybe be overly polemical, say, so what, right? So what? And what I mean by that is that Jeff says these popular movements were pushing and radical and they're in the streets, and the mas seemed more concerned about winning the election. And my question is that not a valid or legitimate concern? Was it not is there room for strategy, I think is one of my questions. Is there a room for a strategic withdrawal from the most radical elements of the movement at that moment of sort of negotiation, at that moment when the mas thinks that it can take power? Are we, although actually I want to know your answer at this moment, but are we worse off with Morales in power than if the mas had rejected participation in the elections, for example, push some of these more radical strategies? There's even suggestion, and I want to push back, certainly, and this isn't you necessarily, some of the people you're quoting, the suggestion that the mas had sort of vested interest in maintaining the continuity of the system and the constitutional structures, because I actually think that part of what's going to happen in a different way in Bolivia than happened in Ecuador and in Venezuela, but happened nonetheless, is a transformation of these constitutional structures. This is part of what's going on in Latin America, is this sort of new moment where the radical left is demanding constitutional change, demanding a return to constituent force, which allows us to basically say, no, we can completely rewrite the laws, right? And to then use part of what, what I argue in the book is to then use what is written, which is always going to be a partial document, it's always going to be a more moderate document than we want it to be, as a sort of foothold to leverage more radical transformations. So then my first question then is should the mas not have worried about the elections? Was that a problem? Do we not allow some room for strategy? And I think we can critique things as a bad strategy. That was a bad strategy. This was a good strategy. But we need to at least, I think, allow space for there to be strategic decision making and not sort of conflate that with principles. The second question has to do with the dialectic or process unleashed by these events. And whether or not our position is sort of to be frustrated by the way that they're going, or to give them a little space to play out and push them in one direction or the next. And maybe that's not very clear. I'll try to make it clear. On the one hand, and I've sort of indicated and suggested toward this already, is that there's no way to take Hugo Chavez in 1998 and explain what he then becomes, even just in terms of what his program, his platform, the sort of beliefs that he espouses. And this is too individual a focus, but I use it as a sort of mechanism to get something across. And so, namely, if what we're trying to figure out is how processes become more radical, I get worried when we're at the beginning saying this should have happened, when part of what plays out is precisely this radicalization sometimes. So, for example, one of the things that the mas, that radical constituent level was demanding was the abolition of the Congress, right? This is when MAS was trying to win power, and so the MAS backed off of this demand to disband the Congress. Part of what happens in these constituent processes that are happening across Latin America is there's always this sort of dual power struggle where you have an old legislature that exists and you have a new constituent assembly. And the constituent assembly says, no, we're the constituent assembly, fuck off, we can do whatever we want. And the old legislature says, we were elected, we still have some power. And at some point, in many of these cases, there simply has to be the abolition of this old Congress. And I say that partly because you said, MAS backed off of the demand of the abolition of the Congress. And that may have been, again, a strategic error, because it did lead to a whole period in which the government is struggling over this new constitution and how to, get it approved, right? There's a whole, they walk out for a whole period. And so there's a dam that has to be broken at some point again. But, you have the same thing playing out in Ecuador and Venezuela, and it wasn't that the leaders at the beginning were saying, we need to do this, we need to dissolve the Congress. It wasn't that they were embracing these more radical perspectives, but it was simply that at a point in the course of the playing out of the process, that had to happen. And it's controversial, et cetera, but it happens. Ecuador, they dissolved the Congress, Venezuela, the same thing. And I think in Bolivia, you can look at what happened and say, well, effectively, they kind of did, right, at one point. Or they, through the process of the, eliminating the importance of these more conservative members, they, forced through what had to be forced through. Thirdly, and this is actually more related than maybe it sounds, is that there's a one of Jeff's major contributions in this book is the concept of what's called combined oppositional consciousness. And it's not limited to, but heavily comprised of class consciousness, a certain kind of class consciousness infused with and generated alongside a history of indigenous struggles and indigenous consciousness, and also into imperial consciousness and things like that. And my question is this, I guess my question is, what is combined oppositional consciousness? Is it a purely contextual concept, which in Bolivia means class plus this, this, and this, but somewhere else would mean something else? Do we need it because we're arguing with people who think only class consciousness matters? Like, is that why we need a new concept that says this is, you know, combined oppositional consciousness, so we can infuse and bring in these other consciousnesses? And part of the concern is that this effort to maybe systematize a new idea of consciousness, or typologize a form of consciousness, is in some ways an attempt to explain sort of the source of these developments. To say people had this kind of consciousness, that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. And again, the worry is similar to the question about, you know, the playing out of the process, which is that I'm not sure that these things can be sort of generated, the sort of a posteriori descriptions of consciousness that we get afterward. My worry is that maybe they don't explain as much as we want them to explain. I think it's of course, it seems like a good summary of the different components of consciousness, and a good, like I said, if we need to push back against old Marxist, I think it seems like a good way to push back, because it's sort of in their language. But do we need something, you know, is this a necessary concept, I think, for grasping what's going on in Bolivia?